From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Two planes in Russia crashed on Tuesday, just minutes apart. Initially, the Russian government downplayed the likelihood of terrorism. That changed today, as a high-level Putin official said that terrorism is now considered the leading possible cause of the catastrophe. Russian media are talking about Russia's 9/11. No evidence has yet been found to confirm suspicions of a terrorist attack, but even without hard evidence, some are already speculating that the upcoming presidential election in Chechnya is the reason for the attacks. The prospect of more terrorism is a reality that President Vladimir Putin is not rushing to embrace. Tonight, On Point, two plane crashes, the possibility of a Russian 9/11, and what it means if terrorists are to blame. We go first to Moscow for the latest developments, where Peter Baker has been reporting on the story for The Washington Post. I asked him who is saying what in Moscow today about Tuesday's plane crashes.
Well, today a senior official appointed by President Putin said that terrorism actually is the main theory, and that at least one of the planes seemed to come apart in midair, and that could indicate an explosion.
We know that at least one of the jets did have time to get a distress signal out. Is there anything further from witnesses or the flight recorders to tell us why they might have crashed?
No, and the authorities who had predicted that the flight recorders would tell them an awful lot yesterday, today suddenly decided that they weren't very good and it would take them days, if not weeks, to analyze. It's a very sensitive time. There's a key election in Chechnya on Sunday, and the government seems not very eager to have these plane crashes seen as terrorism in the days before that election.
Is that right? Because they've been so quick in the past of accusing the Chechen rebels of having a hand in terrorist acts, even before investigations have begun. Would they rather have the Russian people think their planes just fall out of the sky?
Well, that would seem like a strange calculation to make, wouldn't it? That somehow incompetence would seem better than being victims of terrorism. But in the strange calculation of Russian politics and the war in Chechnya, it sounds like that people would prefer to believe it was human error or some sort of technical malfunction.
Now, I understand that the Russian media have been calling this Russia's September 11th.
Well, that's right. The Russian press has. The Russian television, which is under control of the state, doesn't even use the word terrorism most of the time. But the print press, the newspapers, have been very vocal in saying, of course this is a terrorist attack. What else could it be?
Well, when we talk about a terrorist attack, is it necessarily the Chechen rebels who might be involved? I mean, what is the possibility that it might be al-Qaeda or another group?
Well, the Chechen guerrillas have had some interaction with al-Qaeda and other outside groups, but it seems any act that would actually take place in Russian soil would almost certainly be involving Chechnya and Chechens themselves. There have been no evidence of al-Qaeda itself here committing these types of attacks on Russian installations or targets.
You've mentioned that the elections, of course, in Chechnya are coming on the weekend. Is it even likely that we're going to get anything more definitive on what happened to these planes before that election, given the Russian government's concerns?
They've made very clear they don't plan to tell us what happened until Monday at the earliest, which is conveniently enough the day after the election.
Right.
You know, but information spills out, like this top official today who apparently said things that they didn't want him to say about the nature of the plane coming apart in the air. They showed that on state television, for instance, in the middle of the day. Then by the evening, that was excised from the broadcast. It was no longer shown.
You certainly do sound like they're being careful about what they're putting out there. How about the security at airports? Have any changes been made there?
They've beefed up security in the last few days. They certainly put a lot more men there, and they're screening people with obviously a great deal of scrutiny. President Putin is also moving rather rapidly to put all airport security under the control of the Interior Ministry, which is basically the national police, and taking it away from the airports and airlines themselves. So they certainly act as if they're dealing with a terrorist threat here.
Has it affected in any way the Russians' willingness to travel?
Well, Russians are sort of fatalist about these things. You know, they've had an awful lot of terrorist attacks in the last 2 years. Even aside from whether these two plane crashes are terrorist acts, they've had about 500 people killed in bombings and other terrorist activities just in the last 2 years. And Russians continue to go about their lives. They don't seem to really alter behavior as a result of it. This is part of life here as it is right now.
Looking ahead to the time that comes after the results of the Chechen election, what does this mean for negotiations for the Russian government?
What they're trying to do is Chechenize the situation. They can put in place a loyal Chechen government that will run things there, then slowly withdraw Russian forces and turn everything over to that guy and basically leave him on his own. If he can handle things, they would be just as happy.
Now, I understand that the elections themselves are viewed by many Chechens as simply being jury-rigged and a sham. How are they viewed by the Russian people?
The Russian people aren't paying very much attention to them. I don't think that they think that it's a legitimate election either. The main candidate who would have challenged the Kremlin's hand-picked choice, a man who's actually very popular in Chechnya, was stricken from the ballot on the grounds that his passport said that he was born, his place of birth was Chechnya, instead of the Chechen English Republic, which is the way it was called in the years that he was born. So that discrepancy on his passport made him not a legitimate candidate. So it doesn't seem like this is an election with any genuine competition.
And also, even if you were hand-picked by the Russian government to make the run for office, you'd have to be kind of a brave person to be doing that in Chechnya these days.
Well, that's right. They've already assassinated this man's predecessor, Akhmad Kadyrov. He was killed in a bomb blast on May 9th. The Russian, who was appointed to serve as acting president in his place, has already been the subject of one assassination attempt, and the guerrillas have vowed to kill whoever wins on Sunday.
Victory may come at quite a price. Peter, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Peter Baker is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Moscow. We're talking tonight about Tuesday's plane crashes in Russia and the possibility they were terrorist acts. What does it mean for Russia, Chechnya, and the U.S.? When you heard about two planes going down just minutes apart, what did you think? Tragic coincidence or terrorism? What are the questions that you want answered about what really happened? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Sarah Mendelson, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and an expert on Chechnya. Welcome, Sarah.
Good evening.
Also with us from Washington is Fiona Hill, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. She's co-author of The Siberian Curse, How Communist Planners Left Russia Out in the Cold, a book she wrote with Clifford Gotti. Good evening, Fiona. Welcome.
Thanks, Jennifer.
If memory serves, going back to the subway bombing in Moscow last February, a bombing in which 40 people were killed, Vladimir Putin said before the investigation even began that no circumstantial evidence was needed to accuse the Chechens, and he vowed right then to eliminate them. And given what's happened today, even with a high-level Russian official saying that terrorism could be involved and quickly yanked off the TV news, Putin himself is not making those kinds of blanket attack statements against the Chechen rebels. Sarah, what do you think is going on there?
I think that President Putin is very interested in conveying a message that life is normal in Chechnya. I mean, you can't have elections in the middle of a war. And if planes are falling out of the sky because of terrorism, that would suggest that there is an ongoing problem in Chechnya. Now, we do a lot of surveys at CSIS on how Russians think about Chechnya, and about half of respondents know somebody who has fought in Chechnya. So it doesn't matter too much what the president says, because people have neighbors and friends who serve and they hear something else. So the president can stay mum as long as he wants, but people, I think, know, they may not want to think about it, but they know on some level what's really going on.
Well, and this is a country full of people who have become quite astute over the years of reading between the lines. There is another message the government is sending out, whether they intend to or not, by putting the Interior Ministry in charge of the airport. You don't put law enforcement there if it was bad jet fuel that caused these crashes, do you?
No, in fact, they would only have responsibility if they believed it was a terrorist event. And that was a signal to some of us that they were, in fact, thinking that it was a terrorist event. They are also, though, the people who were in charge of investigating bombings of apartment buildings that happened in September 1999. In those cases, some of the blast areas were cleared within hours or days of the event, and it was never clear that a thorough investigation was done, or an investigation that would stand up to international standards.
There are conspiracy theories that exist to this day, are there not, that the Russian government actually may have been involved in some sort of agent provocateur role there?
It's frankly just impossible to say. We have no evidence. What we have is evidence from a town about 3 hours outside of Moscow, Ryazan, where some citizens came upon what they believe was a bomb that didn't explode, and then there was sort of a lot of bizarreness. The thing was taken away. People said it was sugar. It was a test. I think Russian citizens, by and large, are very skeptical about the kinds of investigations that are being done by the authorities.
Fiona Hill, I'd like to bring you in on this. If terrorists are indeed responsible for these plane crashes, what does that tell us about Vladimir Putin's anti-terror campaign thus far?
Well, this is obviously a very sensitive subject for Vladimir Putin, because he's really trying to present himself as the law and order president. And also, indeed, his presidency has been defined by his contention right at the very beginning of the presidency, which, of course, occurred right with the outbreak of this second round of war in Chechnya. His presidency has been defined by the fact that he said repeatedly, wipe out the Chechen terrorists, and that he would then go on to stamp out terrorist acts across Russia. So this is patently something that is very painful to him personally, because he has personally associated himself with ending this conflict, just as he was associated with the very beginning of it back in 1999.
And coming as it does this Sunday with Chechen rebels promising, and I guess they have been promising this ever since the election was announced, that they would be doing things to disrupt it. So we are left now with right back at square one in terms of complaints from the international community about whether this election could even take place and whether the region was stable enough to handle any kind of a vote. Fiona, just a brief comment from you. I'd also like to get Sarah to weigh in on that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have had several statements from the Chechen rebel president, Aslan Maskhadov, who was elected several years ago in what many contend was the last, at least, approximation of a democratic vote in Chechnya, though that also took place during a time of continued conflict. But he has said, most recently as this last month, that the Chechen rebel forces would escalate their attacks, that they would take their attacks outside of the territory of Chechnya into Russia proper. And he even did hint that they might try different tactics in line with the continued bombardment by planes, helicopter gunships, you name it, by the Russian forces on the Chechens. I mean, this all has a great deal of reverberation for, I think, any of Russia's neighbours watching this right now, because we're seeing the real risk of an escalation and spillover of the conflict in June of this year, not long after the assassination of Chechen President Ahmad Kadyrov. We saw an incursion of forces into the neighbouring Republic of Ingushetia. And since that happened, it was a massive raid. Tens of people were killed, a large number of forces. It has become clear that some of those forces were not, in fact, Chechen, but, in fact, the majority of them may have been Ingush, who themselves are now feeling greatly frustrated by Russia's policies in the region and may be taking matters into their own hands. There's continued violence in the other republic on the other side of Chechnya, in Dagestan, repeated assassinations of government officials there, regular shooting, bomb attacks. An enormous bomb went off in Dagestan during a military parade in the last few months. So we're seeing the gradual spillover of tension, conflict and of violence into a much broader region around Chechnya,
with all sorts of repercussions, and not just for Russia.
That's absolutely right.
Okay. I'd like you both to stay right where you are. We're going to pause just briefly here. We're talking tonight about Tuesday's plane crashes in Russia, what it means for Russia, Chechnya, and the upcoming Chechen elections this weekend. Regardless of whether Chechen rebels were responsible for the two plane crashes, what do you think about how the Chechen rebels are pursuing their cause? Do you sympathize? Do you believe the violence won't get them what they want? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the plane crashes in Russia, about what it means for Russia, Chechnya, the U.S., and the world. Do you support President Putin in his handling of the Chechen rebels in Russia? Or is the Russian government making the situation worse? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me from Washington is Sarah Mendelson, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and an expert on Chechnya. Also with us from Washington is Fiona Hill, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Sarah, if I can go back to you for a moment, there has not been a claim of responsibility in this, but would that be unusual if Chechen rebels were involved?
Actually, thinking back, though, a few weeks, there were threats that this was going to happen. And in fact, they talked about whether or not they could get airplanes and if they had access to airplanes. So that's frightening. And that's certainly, you know, you're looking at it as a crime. And on the one hand, there's motive. On the other hand, there have been threats. On the other hand, there is a history of this, right? I mean, we know we have watched Chechen terrorists take hostages in theaters. But I want to just pause for a second because I feel a little bit both fatigue and anger in the sense that every time there is some event that happens, that's when people want to talk about Chechnya. And in between those events, in between terrorist acts, there are people that are disappearing every day. I get emails, Fiona gets emails all the time from organizations on the ground, you know, very brave people who are tracking this.
Well, we're talking about it now, Sarah, so what point would you like to make there?
The point is that how long are we going to go without having a serious response from the international community? The organizations that have as their duty observing compliance with democracy and human rights, the United Nations, the OSCE, the Council of Europe, have really done very, very little. And frankly, you know, U.S. policy, there is no U.S. policy on Chechnya. U.S. policy on Russia has been adrift for quite some time.
I'd like to get into that aspect of American involvement in it in a moment, but I'd also like to bring some of the callers in on the discussion at this point. Vijay is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Vijay, welcome. Hi. You're on Point.
Hi. Thank you. I just have a comment that when the Madrid bombings happened, and including myself, we were all pretty quick to point out that it was the Ba'ath separatist group, ETA, including myself. And it was only after several days when we realized who was really behind those bombings.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I heard about the plane crashes, and yes, a few minutes apart. You do have to think that there was something behind this. But before we go pointing fingers to the Chechen group, maybe we should find out who was behind it before we go pointing out people. Because I just remember the Madrid bombings, and including myself, I was as soon as I heard about it, within a split second, I thought that it was ETA, and how wrong was I?
And, you know, we don't even have to go overseas. When you think back to the Oklahoma City bombing, how many people were talking about, you know, foreigners, and it turned out to be an American involved in that with Timothy McVeigh.
Right.
Well, how do you feel about the possibility that Al-Qaeda might be involved if these planes were taken out purposefully?
To be quite honest, I honestly believe that it were the Chechens behind this attack, just given all the other circumstances. In this case, I wouldn't think Al-Qaeda would be behind them. I would be somewhat surprised if they were, but also at the same time, well, once again, I myself learned a very hard lesson after the Madrid bombings, and it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about myself as well.
Thank you, Vijay. Fiona, what do you make of that, that we may be a little quick here given what happened in Madrid?
Well, Vijay is absolutely right. I mean, there are many plausible explanations for what happened with the planes. Terror.
Are there really? What else is plausible in your mind?
Well, there are other things that have been discussed in Russia about the possible uses of terror by groups other than Chechens, groups other than groups that are pushing political agendas. We've had several experiences in Russia over the last few years of terror used for commercial purposes, for criminal groups, organized crime groups, different business groups choosing to assassinate someone, to cause plane crashes, has actually happened before. On many number of occasions. The fact is that those are all acts of terror. It's just different groups have chosen this method of pushing their agenda, be it, as I said, criminal or commercial, or be it political. So, I mean, I think there are other explanations here. The fact about the Madrid bombings was this was an act of terror. It didn't matter mm-hmm. who had perpetrated it, it was an act of terror, and we have to remember this. So unless this is some absolutely bizarre, catastrophic malfunction, be it caused by inadequate fuel or some horrific maintenance problem, if it is an act of terror, this is still a major problem, and it doesn't matter who perpetrated it.
Right.
I think the other issue is that we're talking about Chechnya because Chechnya deserves to be talked about on its own, irrespective of what has happened in this this all-consuming tragedy right now in Russia, mm-hmm. that we have a situation that has now dragged on for more than a decade. We're going to enter, at the end of this year, a second decade of war in Chechnya, in an area that is inherently unstable. We've now got conflict rearing itself again just south of Chechnya, in Georgia, in the Republic of South Ossetia, that has also been in the news. We have conflicts that we think of as frozen across this whole region in Abkhazia and Nagorno-Karabakh, which are anything but. And we have a broader arc of stability across this whole region at the south of Russia. The Russians are very concerned about this. And the big question is, what can the Russian government do now to try to cauterize this, to try to prevent the war in Chechnya from escalating further? Because irrespective of what happens in these elections on Sunday, this war will continue. That's the sad fact.
We have another question from a caller here. Peter is calling from Antioch, Illinois. Welcome to On Point, Peter.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about... If your guest could talk about the support for Chechens or lack of support among the Russian populace and how this could possibly damage it, you know, if you think of, quote-unquote, you know, innocent people on an airliner mm-hmm. crashing, that doesn't seem... And I know they have a tradition of bringing the war home, you know, with the theaters and everything, but just how this could possibly... I hate to use the term PR, but how this could...
Yes.
Work in a public relations sector, sort of, you know.
Okay. Sarah, Peter Baker was telling us earlier from Moscow that a lot of Moscovites at least seem to be somewhat indifferent to what's going on in Chechnya. Do you have a view of maybe what the broader populace might think, not only of what's going on, but also of the tactics being used by the Chechen rebels?
Well, we have quite a precise view of how Russians think about Chechnya from surveys that we've done since 2001. And we have a lot of stability in their views. About 5% like the status quo. That is, they like the way the government has pursued the war,
yeah.
which suggests
right.
that that's not very good. but what's happened over time is that the number, and then they're split. You know, there's about maybe 30%, 35 who want intensification, and then another 35, 40% who want some form of negotiation, withdraw, maybe keep the troops there, but have some kind of discussion. So not surprisingly, pundits around the world, experts around the world are not sure what the policy course should be. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised the Russian population isn't sure. But the, you know, we don't see a huge jump in, for example, anger at Chechens. What we see is tremendous amount of stability in concern and anxiety, real anxiety about the number of soldiers that have died yeah. and the cost of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear it in focus groups as well. I mean, there's this sort of duality of how people think about it. On the one hand, they don't necessarily want to talk about it. On the other hand, it's a very painful issue, and it's one that they'd like hidden, but it's sore and like it won't go away, and it's affecting life and the body politic, and you see it in polls, you feel it in focus groups.
Do we know anything about their views? And not, I'm thinking not only in Russia here, but also in Chechnya, about the tactics being used, about the violence, because this has been an issue for all kinds of groups, from the IRA to the Palestinians.
Well, I don't think there's any population on earth that generally approves of terrorism. Polling that has been done in Chechnya is very difficult. And I'll tell you, it really points to the fact that there are not conditions for elections in Chechnya.
Yeah, right.
When you talk to pollsters, you know, they're able to cover maybe 30% of the territory. It's just simply not safe enough. And if you can't do a survey, then, you know, you really don't have conditions to do an election. But I think that, you know, the one thing I find very disturbing that I do hear in focus groups is that sometimes people feel that they should just level the place, just make it go away. I've even heard people say, you know, Stalin had it right when Stalin deported the entire Chechen nation
to Siberia.
Yes, well, to Kazakhstan. And you know, it's impossible to think that they don't understand the history that they're living with. You know, it's as if they've never been taught what really happened. It's impossible to sit in a room and listen to people talk about the Stalin response as a reasonable one.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that it bears on this continuing war in Chechnya, that there are these gaping memory holes that haven't been filled and haven't been addressed.
Yeah, just big holes
really
in the history
impact.
Books for children going back decades. I'd like to go back to the phones now. And if you would like to join us, give a call. The number here is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm going to take a call now from Spokane, Washington. Joe, you're on Point.
Good evening. You know, prior to 9/11, we condemned Russia for the war in Chechnya. Now we are just like Russia. We're in a little war that's not too popular either. And it appears to me that the war on terror is like this giant military machine of Russia squashing a small country like Chechnya and us doing the same thing in Iraq. And I think we're total hypocrites, and we don't even care what Russia does anymore because we're just like them. Look at Abu Ghraib prison. We have people in prison around the world that nobody even knows about. Kind of reminds me of Stalinist Russia. And that's what I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Sarah, I know you want to comment on that because that's the issue you were bringing up earlier.
Well, I think that there is certainly the reality that the United States is wrestling, and the Pentagon is wrestling with military misconduct is a human rights and security issue, and that when troops engage in human rights abuses, they bring they increase the threats to the troops that they serve with. And we see that in Iraq. It's very clear. It's very difficult, though, to compare, frankly, the U.S. military and the Russian military. The condition of the Russian military at the moment is, you know, unfed, untrained, trafficking in arms in places in order to pay for, you know, what's going on, trafficking in humans and other places, and including some evidence in Chechnya. So, yet there are dangers when you engage in wars that your population doesn't understand and that your troops don't understand and they're not well equipped to fight. And the pressures on the troops are very intense. And to that extent, there may be some similarities.
What about the first point that Joe made there, that since 9/11, we really haven't had, in the United States anyway, at an official level, a lot to say publicly about how Russia is pursuing its case with Chechnya?
Well, quite honestly, before 9/11, there was a lot of interest. I mean,
is that fair, though? I mean, has there not been a difference since Russia has become a partner in the war on terror?
No, honestly, there's been really not much. I mean, there were, I think, a member of the Clinton administration would tell you that, well, we raised it at Istanbul in 1999, December. But quite honestly, there have been absolutely no ramifications. There were no implications. There was no, you know, my father used to say behavior has consequence. Well, apparently not. And in both the Clinton-Russia policy and in the Bush-Russia policy, it just did not figure.
Now, I know that you disagree with that, Sarah, but what does the United States risk if it alienates Russia in this war on terror?
Well, I think, you know, let's talk about Russia. I mean, obviously there's a significant part of the population that is interested in democracy. I mean, what we're talking about is alienating certain people in the Kremlin if you criticize this. And I think it's important to think about who our real friends in Russia are. And I think our real friends, those who want an open society, I think the best way to fight terrorism, or those who don't want the, you know, an open society, is to support, you know, folks who are interested in democracy. I think that there's a way in which when we ignore what goes on in Chechnya, that we embolden security services, that we are increasing, we're allowing the kinds of tactics that have increased extremism rather than contained extremism in Chechnya.
Jennifer, can I come in on
yes,
this one?
Yes, Fiona, I was about to turn to you.
I was going to say, my accent gives me away that I was not born in the United States. And putting a personal hat on rather than a scholar's hat here, I actually grew up in a country, Great Britain, in which terrorism was a prominent feature of life, particularly mm-hmm. from the 1970s with Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And what Sarah is saying about Russia here has to be put in this kind of context, because we have a number of countries around the world, including well-developed democracies like Great Britain, also India, which of course has been going through a process of democratization for a very long time now, certainly the last 60 years, Israel, and another democracy in the Middle East, Turkey, a country that has also been going through a long, drawn-out process of democratization. And all of these four countries have in common a very similar situation to Chechnya, with different degrees, of course, of brutality by the armed forces, or the use of terrorism by the insurgents, militants, whatever you want to call them. But in every single case, the domestic affairs of those states has been very negatively affected by the experience of the battle with terrorism. It was certainly the case in Great Britain. I can think of many other experiences in my own personal life, of my history teacher at school, for example, of being arrested simply because he was the cousin of someone who was associated with the IRA, very unexpectedly detained for a long period of time before being released. Numbers of incidents of people being thrown into jail, which inflamed popular sentiment against the British military in Northern Ireland, sectarian violence going on. And yes, people kept on going. They behaved like the Russians, very stoic. The idea that you might be blown up on the subway or on a train or when you're doing your shopping became a daily part of life. It wasn't quite as extreme, obviously, as the situation in Israel, but it certainly had a very negative effect. And it was only with outside intervention that something was changed in the case of Britain. If it hadn't been for the United States and other members of the international community intervening, I don't think we'd be where we are today. And nothing is perfect in Ireland. We're still in the process of the Northern Ireland negotiations. There's always ups and downs. But certainly the situation in Northern Ireland today is a far sight better than it is in Kashmir, in the Palestinian territories within Israel, and certainly an awful lot better than it is in Chechnya. Okay. And I think that there is a lesson from that.
Okay, stay with us, Fiona. We're discussing the two plane crashes in Russia, what that tragedy means for the country, for Chechnya, for the U.S. and the world. Is this a warning sign that the international community needs to do more to resolve a regional crisis? That's Fiona's argument. Or is it something that Russia should handle differently, and if so, how? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the repercussions from the two plane crashes in Russia. Has this crisis made you question the way the war on terror is being pursued around the globe? Is Russia doing its part well or badly? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me from Washington is Sarah Mendelson, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and an expert on Chechnya. Also with us from Washington is Fiona Hill, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Fiona, I'd like to turn to you again, and I'd also like Sarah to weigh in on this question. When we're talking about, you're saying that you think that there's need for third-party involvement here and suggesting the U.S. should be that. What exactly is it that you would have the United States do?
Well, to be honest, I didn't actually suggest that the United States be
somebody.
That.
Somebody.
raise the United States in the context, for example, of the United States playing a very positive role in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
You have to actually choose your interlocutor with great care. And as we've seen, the US hasn't exactly been the most successful intervener in the conflict in the Middle East, in Israel, precisely because the United States is not seen as an honest broker in that conflict by at least one of the parties.
Would that be the case here, do you think?
I think exactly that would be the case. The Russians would resent it deeply. And the Chechens also may not exactly trust the United States, because there were early appeals in the first war in Chechnya to the United States to take some action, and the United States did not, precisely because of the larger considerations of the relationship with Russia and a whole number of other issues. We have had interventions by the international community before, at least half-hearted ones. The OSCE, the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, that also did not turn out very successfully, and the Russians have also made it very clear that that is not a mechanism that they want to use again in the future. So the question remains, just as it does in many of the other conflicts I mentioned in Kashmir and elsewhere, of how do you craft a third-party intervention? How do you create circumstances in which both of the parties can appeal to another group in helping them to mediate the conflict? There are other conflicts going on in the region where the United Nations have also tried to help, where groups of countries have been put together, for example, the case of Nagorno-Karabakh, Russia, France, the United States, and others have created a separate grouping. It's not clear in the case of Chechnya that that would be possible, and it's also the fact that the government in Moscow is extremely reluctant to have any third-party intervention. So
Sarah,
we reach again a bit of a block there.
Sarah, I'd like to hear you on that same question about how, if at all, an intervention would be possible.
Well, I think we have to face certain realities. The path that we're on is not working. We know that the Russians know we know it. and we need to be thinking about different kinds of strategies. What I worry about is that there are not actually that many times when people come together and are thinking outside the box on this issue. And that, you know, there's been a lot of attention on Northern Ireland. There's been a lot of attention on Israel, Palestine. But there has not been a huge amount of attention on this. And we need it. And it's funny because I remember when Bill Clinton actually went to Russia and he addressed the Duma. And he mentioned this example of Northern Ireland, and he sort of said, listen, you guys can go and kill yourselves for the next 30 years, or you can actually sit down with mediation and we can find some kind of solution. It's kind of up to you. And I think that people may have thought he was suggesting the Americans do it, and he wasn't. It was that there are certain kinds of times when mediation is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite candidate for mediators on this one are Scandinavians, but I don't quite know how the Russians would feel about that.
That's interesting. Let's take another call here. Jeff is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I guess I have two basic questions, points. I was wondering if Ms. Hill and Mendelsohn could address the what I consider to be a term that has dropped out of the lexicon, particularly since 9/11, and that is state terror. And two, perhaps Ms. Mendelsohn could provide a little bit more historical context. I mean, I wonder how many people listening know that the Chechens were the great resistors to Tsarist domination in the 19th century at great cost to themselves, and that the removal was by Stalin was essentially a form of genocide, since 40-50% of the population died in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is the background for the ferocious resistance to a even more ferocious assault on the Chechens is going on for years.
Jeff,
anyway, those are my questions and points.
Okay, I have a question for you, though, Jeff, just to sharpen up that first one. When you're talking about state terror, do you want to know why it's not used in reference to the Putin government?
I think it should be in that specifically. Perhaps they could. I think it's simply vanished from the discourse about terrorism altogether, and perhaps they might want to advert to that, but particularly in reference to Russia.
Okay, all right, Fiona, do you want to take that up?
Well, this is our big dilemma, isn't it, since 9/11, but perhaps even before that. We always had the problem of one man's terrorist being another person's freedom fighter, which has actually really created some bitter divides among the various people looking at Chechnya. because once terror acts were chosen by the Chechens as they thought a legitimate mechanism for fighting back against Russia, that obviously led to an awful lot of people immediately putting them in the category of many of the worst offenders, and of then putting aside the genuine grievances against the Russian state that our caller Jeff outlined. It's very true that the Chechens have been resisting their incorporation into the Russian Empire first for many years. In fact, they were the last group brought into the Russian Empire. Mm-hmm. That's something that people don't realise.
Right.
They were the very last group incorporated, long after everyone else had become a constituent part of the Russian Empire, because they just kept on fighting. And that has been a persistent theme of the coexistence, if one could call it that, with Russia and then with the Soviet Union. There have been periods where the Chechens have been well incorporated into the larger body politic, but more often than not, there have been these terrible flare-ups of war and conflict, and of atrocities carried out against the Chechens by the Soviet and Russian state. So we do have a problem here.
Sarah?
And the whole idea of state terror, obviously, is a very sensitive one for most governments. The United States, Great Britain, many people would, of course, bring up the issues of World War II and decisions that states made in fighting that, to use the bomb in Hiroshima or to firebomb Dresden. It's all an incredibly contentious set of issues, which gets raised again now in the context of the war on terrorism. And I think that's something that will be very hard for us to resolve tonight.
Sarah, I have a quite specific question for you about what life is like in Chechnya now. I mean, it has certainly been in the past a warlord's paradise, with dozens, if not more than 100 kidnappings, many of which ended very badly. I'm wondering what, for the average Chechen, it's like to be there now.
Well, schools aren't functioning, hospitals aren't functioning, or they function sporadically. If you're moving from point A to B, and A to B is longer than, I don't know, a couple hundred meters, you're running into, you're being shaken down for some kind of pass. My colleagues who go frequently, and they don't like me to ask them on the phone, are they going? You know, they just sort of go.
really?
Find it, yeah. It's, you know, it's very random. And human rights colleagues have been targeted by the authorities, so it's quite dangerous for them. I think the way to understand it is people are trying to continue living in an atmosphere of where the social fabric is completely broken down and where they are, have been, for the most part, more or less been forgotten. I wanted to address just for a second the caller's question about history. I think this issue of the lack of reconciliation with Russia's recent past, I mean, I don't think you have to go to Imperial Russia, but really in the last 50, 60 years, has an impact. And I think it's very dangerous when President Putin or other figures in Russia are able to sort of repackage, if you will, the Stalin period. When we ask voters, or when we ask citizens in Russia, would they support Stalin if he were running for president? 25-26% say yes. You know, if we had a number like that in Germany on a question about Hitler, we'd be very, very nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are consequences to, I think it's Anne Applebaum said in her book Gulag, there are political consequences to absent memory.
Okay, let's go back to the phones here. We have a call from Raj from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Raj. Welcome to On Point.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. The point I'd like to make is the following. The people in the Islamic world, I think, have learned from the lesson of Vietnam and from the lesson of the Mujahideen against Russia that the nationalists have to be willing to sacrifice 10 of their own to get one of the opponents, because in the West there are highly sophisticated killing machines, whether you're talking Russia or the United States or Israel. And as long as the U.S. and Israel and the Russians are willing to operate on the basis that it's okay to kill 10 civilians in order to get one of the militiamen, They're going to have the same attitude on the other side. They're going to seek the vulnerabilities that will target civilians just to make their point. In my view, the situation in Chechnya will not be resolved without independence for Chechnya. And the reason for that is that the younger generation, the post-colonial generation, as I think of it, let me just say I grew up in the Middle East, born in 1935, and I watched the evolution over the last half century.
Mm-hmm.
The post-colonial generation is not willing to accept that the West is going to continue to impose its will upon them simply because it has more efficient killing machines. And I think whether it be Chechnya or you see the slaughter in Iraq where, you know, in order to get the Mahdi army, they killed so many more civilians. And, you know, in all of these places, the reaction is, okay, if it's going to take 10 of us to get one of them, that's what we'll have to do because they have these efficient killing machines. We're not able to do that. That's the only way we can succeed.
Yeah, okay, thank you for that, Raj. Fiona, the point that he's making there is that this is a deep-seated, long-rooted problem that you can't ignore, as the Putin government seems to insist on doing, and yet no negotiations are planned, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's many points that came out in this, and let me just also say that it's not just a feature of the Islamic world here. I mean, I think that the point that he was making about people being willing to fight back would also hold in apartheid South Africa, would also hold in many other settings, mm-hmm. Sri Lanka and elsewhere. So this is a generalized point of when people decide to engage in an insurgency against what they see as an overwhelming force. Now, in all of these instances, there are deep roots for this. Every issue that has come up in point of comparison tonight has hundreds of years of history or decades of history. And this is absolutely right, that this is going to be incredibly hard to disentangle. And Raj made actually one very good point about the younger generation. And this is the real tragedy of Chechnya, because now for more than a decade, there is a whole generation now coming into two generations of young people in Chechnya who have known nothing but war.
Right.
And who don't have a reference point of going back to a time when there were actually close connections with Russia. Now, some of the older generation, I think, in Chechnya, people probably in their 30s onwards, late 30s, 40s onwards, have probably long given up on the idea of independence. And in fact, that was always a misunderstanding in this. There was not a very large percentage of the population in Chechnya who really wanted independence. Many people wanted a different form of autonomy, a different arrangement with Russia. There was a political dispute. There were certainly diehards who wanted to push independence, and they hijacked a lot of other aspirations that were there within Chechnya.
I just want to stop you there, Fiona, because we're running down the clock here, and I just wanted to give Sarah one last chance to get a word in here before we wrap up.
Well, I think there's another side to how and why this war is continuing. Fiona and I have participated in many conversations over the years with other folks in Washington, and corruption inside the armed forces, the Russian armed forces, I think is a factor that the other side, where it's become very difficult to control. And sometimes there's a question of, does President Putin have control over what's going on the ground? If he doesn't, that's a problem. If he does have control, is he approving of this kind of corruption? But there are a lot of us who think people are making some kind of money off of what's going on, that there's something more to it than sort of, you know, ethnic hatred that's driving this.
Mm, always a possibility. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, Sarah and Fiona both.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Sarah Mendelson is the senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Fiona Hill, a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. They both joined us from Washington. You can continue the conversation online if you'd like. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.